Well, I'm going to apologize to people who know what I'm going to talk about. Is this going to start going by itself? Yes. Oh, it is. Yes. Yes. Okay. It goes, if I do that, then it will be over really quickly. We can all go to the reception. So I want to apologize because I'm going to be to the people who know the theory, because I'm going to be saying nothing. Nothing that they don't know, except maybe things that are false, which in which case I hope they'll be kind enough not to tell me until after the talk. I should also apologize for the title, because this is not this is I've forgotten when I made this slide that I changed the title, and I could have fixed it, but really this is more appropriate for today's talk, and then the other two is an introduction to the next two talks, which will be more about questions having to do with motives. So, so this is no use. There's some way to put this. Okay. So this is a quotation from Peter Sarnak, who's very good at providing these quotations. It's as if people were working on the far side of the river waiting for someone to throw this bridge across. And now all of a sudden, everyone's work on the other side of the river has been proven. So that's a good paradoxical way to describe what people had been doing in the field for several decades. What was he talking about? Well, so what are the two sides of the river? What is the bridge? And why do we want to cross anyway? So this is... The bridge was the fundamental lemma, which will be the subject of October's meeting, proved by Ngo Bao Chao, and the only one that I don't know if other mathematical theorems have been listed by Time magazine. I'm sure they must have been, but this was the only one in 2009. And Sarnak's point of view, algebraic number theory was the far side of the river, and this side was sort of automorphic forms, and the bridge is used in the setting of the Langlands program, which is duality between two branches of mathematics that had grown up together in some ways, but really have very different structures. The automorphic representations can be thought of as analysis or geometry or group theory on this side of the river, and Galois representations, which is part of number theory that interests me, on the far side. And it was suggested that I make a parallel between, if I think of the two objects as elementary particles, then the duality is a kind of duality between, I see I can make this, I can say this, but I'm not sure I know what I'm saying. Position representation of the same particle seen as a position space and in momentum space. They are the same object in some sense, or they, the properties of one determine the properties of the other, but they look very different. And the idea is that if you can prove something about an object on one side, then that would suggest dual relations on the other side. But in order to prove these relations, one requires a bridge. And one point that wasn't made is that, maybe I'll try to get to this, automorphic representations, unlike elementary particles, don't have any obvious interactions, whereas Galois representations do. I'll explain that. I'm sorry, I'm just thinking on my feet. So on the far side of the river, the first things one learns are, well, there are infinitely many prime numbers, and more usefully, that the prime numbers control the structure of the Galois group of Q bar over Q, which is the main subject of this talk. So what is the Galois group like? Well, the Galois group is the inverse limit over all Galois extensions, all finite Galois extensions. It's a profinite group. It's compact. Actually, I say that. Compact, but the topology is totally disconnected. And its structure is extremely complicated. In fact, it's this makes it look fairly simple, but in fact, the structure is impossible to inconceivably complicated. However, one can grasp its structure by studying its continuous representations. Now, anytime you have a K, you get continuous representations of the finite quotient, and that is provides some sort of information about the group, but not very much topological information. And the topological information can be captured by looking at finite dimensional representations or rank actions on finite free modules, or not necessarily free modules, over a topological ring. Now, the topological rings one takes are usually the complex numbers or the p-adic numbers or the algebraic closure of the p-adic numbers, which I'll use interchangeably with the p-adic numbers. But one can also take power series rings.
Okay, when you say volume,
algebraic closure, yes. Mm-hmm. Right. So, a representation, let me just write representation for the sake of, I'm not going to say very much about what p-adic representations are, but let me just say that QP, for example, well, such a representation always can be considered as a representation to ZP, and these can be described fairly easily. So rho is a family of homomorphisms and it's not just a collection, it's a collection that commutes with the natural with the natural map. So this is rho I minus 1. This is so that's all this is. This is a collection of it's a collection of homomorphisms to these finite groups, but the way it's been written, this is continuous, and it respects the profinite topology and the topology here given by the inverse limit. But it's much easier to understand these objects than the individual levels. But let me now consider the case of complex representations. So what, for number theorists at least, would be the most familiar special case of Langlands functoriality conjectures is the existence of bijection between two sets. One, the n-dimensional continuous irreducible complex representations. So a continuous complex representation that necessarily factors through a finite quotient. So this is the topology of the Galois group is irrelevant in that case. And then, one can imagine that if you want to understand the Galois group, this would be a natural place to start. And then the other set, whatever it is describes the is a way of parametrizing the former. So these are the automorphic representations of the Adele group, and I'll spend most of the hour explaining what that means. Why, what is the advantage, what is the interest of, the, of this correspondence? Well, there's the Artin conjecture for Q. So the conjecture, which is a fundamental open question in algebraic number theory, much less the theory of motives, is that the Artin-L function is an entire function if rho is not the trivial representation. Let me see what that means. Well, if rho is the trivial representation, then the Artin-L function is just the Riemann zeta function, and it's not an entire function. It has a pole at s equals 1, and the conjecture states that that pole is the unique pole in the whole theory of L functions, in some sense. And the Artin-L function, it looks just like the Riemann zeta function, except the as a Dirichlet series, except the numerators depend on rho. In fact, I'll write the formula will be written down later. It has a meromorphic continuation, converges for the real part of S greater than 1, and a functional equation, and an Euler product, just like the zeta function, but it's holomorphy has only been proved in a very restricted class of cases. And the analytic properties, just as the Riemann zeta function controls, and the Dirichlet L functions control properties of primes and arithmetic progressions, the analytic properties of the Artin-L function control properties of primes, more subtle properties of primes, in non-abelian generalizations. And I'll give a few examples of what I mean by that at the end. So in this lecture, A will be QP or some finite extension of QP, but I'm not going to dwell on that difference. And rather than say what a p-adic representation is beyond the formal definition, here's an analogy. So one way of thinking of a p-adic representation is something like a local system over a surface with infinitely many punctures. So a representation of the fundamental group surface, one puncture for each prime q. That's not quite enough. These two S's are not the same. There's also a set of prime numbers or punctures where the local system has some kind of singularity, unspecified singularity. This actually, something of this sort actually is used, this picture is used in geometric Langlands, in the geometric analogs of the Langlands correspondence. You have a surface or a Riemann surface or curve with finitely many singular points and looking at representations of the fundamental group of the curve with some sort of deeper structure specified at the singular points. So the Galois group is replaced by the fundamental group of the surface, and the loop around the puncture corresponds to a specific element in the Galois group, the Frobenius. For each prime q, there's a Frobenius element, and the Frobenius element is nothing very mysterious. You have the Frobenius in the Galois group of FQ bar over FQ, which takes x to the, well, the Frobenius inverse of x is equal to x to the q. And somehow this gets lifted up in some way to the Galois group of q bar over q. Now, choices have to be made in order to do that. But that's not incompatible with the picture, because in order to identify a loop in the fundamental group, you have to choose a base point. Otherwise, the loop is only well-defined up to conjugation. And so is the Frobenius, only defined up to conjugation. But One advantage of looking at representations is that in a representation of the Galois group only, the conjugacy class really matters. Now, it is conjectured that I left something out. It is conjectured that for the kinds of Galois representations I will be considering, that is, the Galois representations that are attached to motives. So we have the representation, and so Frobenius Q, which is a conjugacy class, goes to an element SQ, which is conjugate to alpha 1 rho Q, alpha n rho Q. In other words, that it's diagonalizable for any. This is a rather strong property. It wouldn't be. It's not true for all the elements of the. In general, this is not a diagonalizable representation. But each individual Frobenius would be conjugate to a diagonalizable matrix, and thus determined up to conjugacy by its eigenvalues. So the analogy between the surface, the representation of the fundamental group of a surface, and representations of the Galois group is flawed in many respects, most notably that the behavior of Frobenius is very, very different from the behavior of a loop around a point, and they don't have the same role. But more importantly, points of a surface are very much like one another. Whereas prime numbers are as different as possible. And one of the main themes, as I said, talking about, and this is what's measured by L functions, to some extent, is that the behavior of prime numbers is constrained in some respect, but where there are no constraints, where there are no motivated constraints, then it's as random as possible. And the word motivated is the same as the word motive. I'll try to explain that at the end. So let me give an example, one example of a motive. This is the one that's most relevant. So so a complex elliptic curve is a Riemann surface of genus 1, which is to say, a torus, C modulo a lattice, and in particular, it's an abelian group. And for the purposes of this lecture, and actually, this is one of the few cases where this is actually a fact, the motive of the elliptic curve is the collection of its cohomology groups. So what are the cohomology groups? Together with additional structure. So the rational cohomology is just Q squared. It's the homomorphisms from the lattice into Q, the lattice being the homology. The Durham cohomology, which is the same object, the complex cohomology calculated by differential forms. And then the Piatek cohomology, for every prime number, there's one. Now, this seems like more information than you actually need. This has structure because there are relations among these. And the Piatek cohomology can be seen just the same way as the rational cohomology, homomorphism for the lattice into QP, but it can also be seen taking the vector space generated by the lattice modulo of the lattice and the homomorphisms from that to QP modulo ZP. And the advantage of this is that inside the group of points of the elliptic curve, this first object is actually the group of points of finite order. So a torus has lots of elements of finite order, and it has, in fact, it has exactly these elements of finite order, q squared modulo L. The relevance of this is that because we're doing number theory, we're not especially interested in elliptic curves over complex numbers. We're interested in elliptic curves over the rational numbers. Well, it's the same thing. By Weierstrass theory, the elliptic curves and the points of a cubic curve, projective cubic curve, are the same thing. But if the coefficients of the cubic curve are rational numbers, well, let's say, make even stronger assumption, let's assume the coefficients are integers, then the group law is also defined over the rational numbers. And that means that the torsion points are less stable under the action of the Galois group. So now, because the Piatic cohomology is given in terms of the torsion points, the Galois group acts on the cohomology. So this is an additional structure that was not visible in the topological setting. And so when I say the motive is, how does it, oh, well, I have to make that go away.
If you just move the mouse away from
it. No. Uh-oh.
If you just move the mouse away from it, not over the, mm-hmm. the menu.
Yeah? I see. Well, how did... Let's see, well, how do I put it back?
Right. So this is why I didn't want to do anything else.
I see. Well.
But okay. What? Did you have to spell it?
No. Okay. So now I have to.
Now full screen.
Full screen.
And now we just move it away from this. Gray box. No, just leave it there.
Mm-hmm. Ah, I actually once knew that. I actually have, had, in fact, I've even discovered that maybe half a dozen times. All right, so the point is that the Galois group is acting on the cohomology. The motive is the collection of all these cohomology groups together with their relevant structures. And since you have the representation, then you can define the L function, which, this is here's the formula for the L function of an n-dimensional Galois representation of any kind. It's for each Q that's where the Frobenius is relevant, you take the determinant of this Euler factor, which is given by the determinant of the characteristic polynomial weighted by q to the minus f, and something, you put in something at the other point. And the analytic continuation, well, that's if you're lucky enough to get an analytic continuation. Now, this actually makes sense if instead of a Piatic Galois representation, I have a complex Galois representation. If I have a Piatic Galois representation, this is really totally illegitimate because the matrix has Piatic coefficients and then q to the minus s. S is a complex variable. So you had better hope that the polynomial has rational coefficients, or at least has coefficients in some number field, some finite extension of the rationals that can be embedded in the complex number, so that this really is a complex function. So now, starting from a Galois representation, without going into details, one does get a complex function, and one of the goals is to study its analytic behavior. That was for a one-dimensional algebraic variety. The motive attached to an Artinel function is the cohomology of a zero-dimensional algebraic variety. So the kinds of L functions I have discussed are all attached to geometric objects. In general, a motive for the purposes of this lecture is some some object, some collection of vector spaces over various fields that can be attached, realized as a cohomology of some algebraic variety. That is the starting point of the theory. This is not a complete theory for the time being. Now, returning to the elliptic curve, the equation can be reduced to modulo primes. That's why I took integer coefficients. And then once you've reduced the equation, then you can count the solutions. Now, the solutions are in a plane. The plane has roughly q squared points. And if you were had a line, if the equation, if it, instead of having a cubic equation, you had a linear equation, it would have q points or q plus 1 points because it's projective. So that's like the optimal number of points, solutions for a curve. And it turns out that the number of solutions as q varies completely determines all the Galois representations. Explicitly, Hasse proved that the number of points is equal to 1 plus q minus the Frobenius, which is equivalent to this formula, I'll say, for the number 1 plus q minus aq, where aq is the trace of rho p of the Frobenius at q for any p. So from that point of view, all the, although there are infinitely many p-adic representations, they all give you the same information. In other words, the Galois representation tells you precisely what, to what extent the number of solutions deviates from the optimal number of solutions, the number of solutions for a linear equation. And I'll get back to the that number at the end. But if the representation is irreducible, and in fact it always is, then the traces of the Frobenius, okay, this I don't need yet. The traces of the Frobenius, these determine rho p up to equivalence. So this is fact two. When I say that the primes determine the structure of the Galois group, I mean specifically this, that when you have an irreducible representation, then the traces of almost all the Frobenius elements determine it up to equivalence. And that's the representation has to be have the property that the set S, where the Frobenius is not defined, is finite. The neglected cohomology groups, the Durand cohomology groups, the ones calculated by differential forms, are going to be the main topic of the next two talks. So I will continue to neglect them today. But now back on the automorphic side of the river, because there's supposed to be a bridge, it has to connect what I've been talking about to something. And this is generally less familiar, so I'm going to define this. And this is a very brief introduction to the representation theory of q-adic groups, which is exactly the same as p-adic groups, except I've saved p for the coefficients of the Galois representation. So it's g is the GLN of qq. A smooth representation is a vector space, practically always infinite dimensional, on which it acts. By a homomorphism, the homomorphism is continuous in the only meaningful sense, because I haven't told you the coefficients of the vector space. I haven't told you what it's over a field, but I haven't told you what the field is. For every vector, the group fixing the vector is open. Now, I'm going to need to know this fact, that every irreducible smooth representation has a property of being admissible, in the sense that if you start with an open subgroup, the space of vectors fixed by the open subgroup is finite dimensional. Now, in fact, it's in many respects it's much easier to understand analytically the representation by looking at the representation of an associated convolution algebra. So now let's consider this space of complex valued functions on G that are compactly supported and locally constant. Since they're, so that remember, the group G is totally disconnected, just because QQ is totally disconnected. So locally constant functions are, so an element of G, H of G, so H in H of G, looks like something like a finite union. So it's this data, it's U in G open compact, and then a finite union of U cosets in G, and then a function on this set. So we've just a finite collection of numbers on the cosets. Now, because these are compactly supported, they're integrable, and so this is a convolution algebra. And if you choose a left invariant measure on G, which allows us to define a representation of this convolution algebra on the same space just by taking essentially the sum of the translates under, if V is invariant under some open compact subgroup, which it is, then you take the translates by the elements of this coset, and you weigh them by the values in this function. That just gives you another way of averaging over the action. And in fact, this gives a homomorphism of the algebra of H under convolution to the endomorphisms of the space. But if pi is irreducible, because it's also admissible for any such function, the dimension of the image is finite, and so you can calculate its trace. And in this way, completely formally, you can define a character. I wrote this. So this is the exact analog of the character of a finite dimensional representation. So you have chi pi of f is equal to the trace of pi of f. If G were a finite group, and a p-adic group, a finite group is also a p-adic group, it's a zero-dimensional p-adic group, then the H of G is just the group algebra, and if you look at the definition, you'll find that this is exactly the way the character works. This is the integral against the character. So this is something I forgot to correct. Finite dimensional representations of finite groups are determined up to isomorphism by their character. So the complete classification by this numerical function. This is true for irreducible or admissible representations in general. It's true for the completely decomposable representations of G are determined by their distribution characters. So this is a classification, and one can do quite a lot with this classification. That's what Jim Arthur's course is about, but I'm not going to go in that direction. I'm only going to look at a very simple case, because remember, I wanted to talk about something to associate to the Frobenius. Now, so the representation is unramified if it has a fixed vector under this maximal compact subgroup. And then inside so H is an algebra without a unit, but if you look at the functions that are invariant on the right and the left under this group K, then it is an algebra with a unit, namely the identity function on K, the characteristic function of K. And very important fact is that this is isomorphic to commutative polynomial algebra. Now, fundamental theorem, starting point for much of this theory for general groups is that the irreducible unramified representation pi is determined not only by the distribution character, but in fact by the distribution character restricted to the subalgebra. And moreover, this, if one has chosen the measure correctly, this is an algebra homomorphism. So it's a homomorphism from a polynomial algebra in n variables. And therefore, the algebra homomorphisms are in one-to-one correspondence with unordered n tuples of non-zero complex numbers. Well, we've already seen unordered n tuples of non-zero complex numbers, although I foolishly erased them. So this is the starting point. This is a really, really old part of the bridge. So we have on the one hand alpha q I rho. On the other hand, we have, let's say, alpha q I pi. That's for the unramified. We start with our representation rho, and then for q not an s, we associate this unordered n tuple, and then we just switch the rho to a pi, and we call this the unordered n tuple that defines an unramified representation, pi q unramified. Now, if q is in S, then we have something else here, and that gives us something else. This is a local Langlands correspondence for GLN, and at the end we get, so q prime, pi q prime, and this is now ramified, but I don't have to tell you what it is, it's just something. It's just another irreducible admissible representation. So the automorphic representation is the collection of these pi q's, and the modularity conjecture is that if rho satisfies certain natural hypotheses, then these are the local components of an automorphic representation. And then, in that case, rho is called an automorphic Galois representation. Well, what kinds of things would have local components? So this collection is the same thing as a, and I also need a pi infinity. This is a representation of GLN of the Adels. I'm not going to be any. So this is a representation of GLNR, irreducible representation. And for that, I get what I will just call a representation of the Adel group. The modularity conjecture says that this object is connected to automorphic forms. And I will be able to say something about that. But first, some applications. Well, at some point, people will get tired of saying this, but it's still the most striking example of the theory. So, when rho is the Galois representation I've already described, attached to an elliptic curve over Q, then the modularity of these representations was proved in many cases by Wiles and Taylor, and that was the main step in the proof of the Fermat's last theorem, and it was completely proved by Taylor and his collaborators a few years later. So this is the kind of thing one can do with the bridge. This was available before fundamental lemma was proved, and I'll just say a few other consequences. So, returning to the theory of elliptic curves over Q, let me just say, I can give you another example of a motive. I can give you another example of a motive that will allow me, you know, I brought in this number N, and if I were only to use N equals 1 and N equals 2, then it would have been, would have gone to waste, and maybe I could have said something simpler. So, starting from rho P, the collection, or the motive E, the E. Well, an elliptic curve is, let me write this as M of E, which is just this collection together with this H and Durham and so on. Now, this is an algebraic variety, but this is a bunch of vector spaces. And the idea of motives is that one replaces algebraic varieties by collections of vector spaces. And let me do what I would be tempted to do with vector space. This representation is, let me say an important fact about this representation. So if we think of E as C modulo lambda, then broad classification of elliptic curves into two classes, the ones where the endomorphisms of lambda are equal to z, that's, and then the ones where the endomorphisms of lambda is strictly bigger than z. So these are called elliptic curves with complex multiplication. And this is without. A theorem of Serre says that the image of rho EP, so if E is without complex multiplication, is equal to GL2ZP for almost all P. This means that completely for free, we get an infinite collection of irreducible Galois representations just out of this one by taking, so this means that for all n greater than 1, or greater than 1, n minus 1, so rho E n is irreducible and n-dimensional. Now, the basic property of motives is that they interact. They interact if you have a motive being one particle and another n being another particle, and then you have, they can interact by taking tensor product. And whatever, and it's still a motive. Well, of course, nobody actually knows how to do that, but in this case, if you have an actual vector spaces, then this makes sense. In particular, whatever properties this representation had, it are retained by any kind of linear algebra operations. In other words, this is the kind of Galois representation that ought to be attached to automorphic forms. So, for free, I give you candidates for objects that should be attached to automorphic Galois representations, to automorphic representations. So, open question. Find pi, or show that. So we have constant n minus 1 rho e. P is associated to some collection of pi q. Show, say pi n of q, show that pi q n is automorphic. What would you get from this? I should tie this into the Artin conjecture. So, very briefly, define LS pi to be equals the product over Q LS pi Q, where LS pi Q is equal to the product of 1 minus alpha I Q. LS pi Q is equal to the product for I equals 1 to N Q to the minus S inverse. Something that looks exactly like the product I gave you for the Frobenius. And this is automorphic in cuspidal. This is this implies that LS by Q is entire. So this is a generalization of what I said before about the Artin conjecture. And if one knows this, one knows it's entire as an analytic continuation functional equation and so on. And if one knows this, then one gets interesting information about non-abelian properties of a distribution of primes. So, I mean, like what I'm about to say. So this is an open problem. One can't prove this. It's open, but one can get the analytic information. Here it is. So suppose you have an elliptic curve without complex multiplication, and we define the number of n aq by the formula I wrote before. Then it's, I should say that aq, I can write it this way, is between twice the square root of q and minus twice the square root of q. That's the house, huh? That's been known for a long time. The theorem is that these numbers, the numbers of solutions, or rather the deviation from the expected number, are equidistributed as q varies with respect to this measure. So this is the Sato-Tait conjecture, which was proved under the hypothesis that the J invariant, which is the invariant that determines the elliptic curve up to isomorphism, is non-integral in 2006. And the fundamental lemma removes the hypothesis on the J invariant. So this is an example of the theorems that had been proved on the other side, but they weren't really proved without the bridge. Here's a similar theorem. So that was a theorem about modular forms of weight 2. Here's a theorem about modular forms of weight 6. So suppose you want to know how many ways a number n can be written as a sum of 12 perfect squares. Well, it turns out that there's a dominant term, which is this, 8 times p to the fifth plus 1. And then the difference is of the order of p to the 5 halves. This is a theorem of Deligne. And generally speaking, the square root of the fact that the deviation is roughly the square root of the dominant term is optimal statistically. And the statement here is that these numbers are equidistributed again with respect to the same measure. Now, this is really an equidistribution theorem in the following sense. What's being distributed is not so much that, this is again a trace of Frobenius. I already told you that AQ was a trace of Frobenius. This is, again, a trace of Frobenius. If you were to look at the Frobenius elements themselves, then they are, this is saying that they are equidistributed in the space of conjugacy classes with respect to the natural measure. So to push forward from the Haar measure. These theorems are proved as a special case of a method of potential modularity, which I will state. So this is the most recent and strongest result, unless there are newer results in the past week. So now you suppose that P is not too small relative to N. And suppose you have a Gower representation that satisfies usual conditions. So the usual conditions are, unramified outside of finite S, some sort of special ramification condition at P that comes from Fontaine's theory. And then there's a polarization condition, which I mean that, for example, the representation should be self-dual. Self-dual would be a good example, or self-dual up to a scalar. Suppose it's not only irreducible, but it's also, if you reduce modulo Q, P, it remains irreducible. Then it would be, one would like to say, because this is what's predicted by the version of the Langlands correspondence given by Fontaine Maeser, one would like to say that it is satisfies the modularity conjecture. That would be saying that this representation, which should be emotive, these conditions say essentially that it's emotive, should correspond to an automorphic representation. One doesn't know that. What one knows is that what you get is not an automorphic representation of GLN over Q, but over some finite Galois extension. In fact, there are infinitely many ways it can be realized over infinitely many different finite Galois extensions. But the open question remains to show that, generalizing this one, to show that it is in fact, it satisfies the modularity conjecture. So this is the generalization of that, of the weaker solution of the open problem. What we are able to prove is that this is potentially automorphic Kussel. That's known. So here's another open question. I think I can stop here. Well, no, I'll say one more thing after this. But first, important development, the Serre conjecture, which is about representations of modulo P, which implies cases of the Arden conjecture for two-dimensional representations, were proved using an argument that, among other things, derived modularity from potential modularity. And the question, important open question, can these be generalized to dimension N? And finally, to return to the near side of the river, the Jim Arthur's course uses the fundamental lemma to prove the following theorem. If G is one of the classical groups, then the local Langlands conjecture is valid for G. That is to say, if you have Gower representations, as I wrote down, for all but finitely many primes, and you can fill in the missing representations on the automorphic side, and the functoriality predicted by Langlands holds between classical groups and GLN. And this proof is conditional on something that remains to be done, but it's in good hands. Yes. Yes, there is another fundamental lemma. Let me tell you what this is. As far as I know, Hales proved that the fundamental lemma for the unit element implies the
fundamental lemma for spherical functions.
Yeah?
Yeah, you don't need, I mean, I did it another way.
Oh.
You don't
It's enough for to have the unit element.
Yeah.
Ah, yes, I think. Oh well, great, great. I think yes. You yes, I think so. There are other places where this is needed, I think, but maybe not. So. Okay. Okay, so this, I guess we get the Galois representation, one doesn't need the other fundamental element. That's what I was thinking of. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, let me very quickly remove that from the before I go around spreading malicious rumors. Okay. Right, well, that was an example. What I gave I'd have to go back to this. Let's see. I mean, this is what I meant. Distribution of some proper. So this. Well, let's see. I mean, this is the distribution of some. This is really the distribution of the traces of Frobenius. So the fact that this can be interpreted in another way is supposed to enhance its appeal. But you can forget about the representing primes as sums of squares, and just look at the image of Galois representation. So this is so there's a two-dimensional Galois representation attached to a modular form of weight 6. The reason things work out so simply in this case is there's just one modular form of weight 6 that interferes, and two-dimensional Galois representation. You look at the trace of the Frobenius at P, and that should be so. This really should be Q. I mean, in terms of the rest of the talk, this should be Q rather than P. So what I'm saying is that the trace of rho of a from Q, these are equidistributed. Or more generally, I actually did want to say this. But I ran out of time, so thank you. More generally, so suppose you have rho from the Galois group of Q, for example, into GLN of QP, and suppose it's the kind of representation that should be attached to motives. So this is like saying the ought of H, Piatic cohomology for motive, okay, whatever that means. Now, and dimension. So you look at the traces of rho Frobenius of Q. Or alternatively, you look at the conjugacy classes of the image. So there's a generalized Sato-Tate conjecture that says that these conjugacy classes are equidistributed in something. What are they equidistributed in? Well, that is a very interesting point. They are not, in general, going to be equidistributed in conjugacy classes in GLN. Not even, in fact, not even in this case are they equidistributed in conjugacy class in GLN, because it's known that the absolute value of the determinant has a certain value. That's why I divided the trace by the twice the square root of Q, because that's, well, I know that that's between minus 1 and 1. Furthermore, in the case of elliptic curves with complex multiplication, one gets a very different law of distribution. So what is governing this? Well, it's the part of the motive I didn't talk about, and this is the subject of a conjecture. The conjecture that there is a group the image of rho is open in a group, I suppose that some people call it GM. This is the Mumford-Tate group attached to the motive. It can be defined in a number of ways. It was proved by Serre for elliptic curves. It's been proved in some other cases. Basically, this is the largest group, this is the largest algebraic group, conjecturally, that fixes all algebraic cycles on powers of the motive, and tensor powers of the motive. So you look at, you think the motive has something geometric, it's also linear algebra. If you remember that it's geometric, then there are algebraic cycles that have to be fixed in some sense. So the conjecture is that this is open in that group, and then it's in that group where you expect to find in addition, there's a property that corresponds to this twice the square root of Q, and beyond that, it should be equidistributed in those terms. And that, in that sense, this generalized conjecture would follow from, first, if it made sense, which depends on the Hodge conjecture, for example. But it would follow from the generalization of the modularity conjecture. And that is what I meant by distributions of primes, non-abelian properties. Images under representations, the conjugacy classes have this distribution property. Well, it's naturally there because it does, if you take the Haar measure and you identify on SU2. So what I did was, you see the eigenvalues, yeah, I should have said this too. These, so alpha I q rho divided by a q the W over 2 is supposed to be, easier to write it this way. You're supposed to know that these are algebraic numbers with absolute value Q to the W over 2, where W is some number that's characteristic of the motive, the weight of the motive. So for an elliptic curve, W is equal to 1. This n minus first symmetric power, the weight is n minus 1. And so because this is fixed, one expects there to so the conjugacy class should be thought of as conjugacy class in SU2. Now, if you take the Haar measure on SU2 and you map SU2 to this base of conjugacy classes just by conjugation, then you can identify it with minus 1, 1, or you can identify it in some other way. But if you identify it with minus 1, 1 by the trace, then you get that measure. So that's why it's natural. Now, why they guessed this was the case, I'm not sure. I heard that Tate was motivated by L functions in some sense, and Sato was motivated by something very, very close to the Ramanujan conjecture. No, it's the L-etic homology. Yeah. So, well, the motive attached to, so I wrote H of M, this is the P-etic homology of the in the proper degree, proper dimension of the variety. Neither. Neither. That's because I wrote down the cohomology explicitly in terms of something which was credible that the Galois group act. So it was in order to avoid defining allylic cohomology. So if I felt it would be more enlightening to talk about allylic cohomology, I could have done that. But there are other cases. On the other hand, the cases for which anything of this sort can be proved are fairly sparse because the methods of Shamur varieties really only allow you to study algebraic varieties or motives whose Hodge spaces are of dimension at most one. There's a reason for that. It has to do with the classification of representations of Lie groups of cohomology. So, for example, if you were interested in the quintic threefolds studied by that at the beginning of mirror symmetry conjectures, and if you look at the quintic threefolds with rational coefficients, rational parameter, the L functions of those are provided the representation is irreducible, which tends to be the case. The L functions of those four-dimensional Galois representations have meromorphic continuation. And you get a part of the equidistribution, but not the whole thing. Any other questions?